Before we go into our interview today, I wanted to let everyone know we have a new sponsor for our Energy Question podcast, the U.S. Oil and Gas Association, or USOGA for short. First established in 1917, USOGA has been an effective and creative voice for the industry for more than a century now. USOGA is dedicated to educating the public, policymakers, and legislators at the federal, state, and local levels about the value of the domestic oil and natural gas industry. If you're in the industry and not currently a USOGA member, please consider joining the association as a way of helping it tell your story to the policymakers whose actions impact everything you do each and every day. You can start that process by contacting USOGA through its website, usoga.org. Thanks so much to USOGA for sponsoring the Energy Question podcast, and now on with our show. Hello, welcome to the Energy Question with David Blackman. I'm your host, David Blackman, and I'm here today with one of my favorite and really one of the finest energy writers working in the space today, Robert Bryce, the author of A Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations, and a fellow who just is doing tremendous work in the energy space. Robert, how are you today?
Well, that's very kind. Thank you, David. Glad to be with you.
Well, I really appreciate you reaching out and taking the time to do this with me. I have always wanted to have you on the podcast, but never was brave enough to reach out with an invitation. So I appreciate it.
Well, I had to invite myself, so I was happy to do that. You know, it's okay.
No, I'd do this with you every week if you wanted to. Listen, before we go into the Q&A, we got a lot to talk about with COP28 going on and everything. But before we go into the Q&A, just take a few minutes, talk about your background, how you became involved in the energy space and things you have going on right now.
Sure. Well, first, I'm a proud father and husband. My wife, Lauren, and I have been married 37 years together, 41 years. We've got three great kids, Mary, Michael, and Jacob. And so they're my first priority. And I always have to brag on them because that's the center of my life. I'm also a journalist, a reporter. I've never had a real job. I've been a reporter my whole career. And that's what I consider myself. You know, people talk, they call themselves energy experts or energy. I'm a reporter. I report on the energy business and I'm proud of that label. I think it's the one that it fits me the best. I want to report on what's going on, but yes, I have a view on it. And my view is born of my experience of writing about energy and power now for more than 30 years. I've written 6 books. My first book was on Enron called Pipe Dreams, Greed, Ego, and the Death of Enron. You mentioned the latest one. Of course, now out in paperback, just came out.
Fantastic.
Question of Power, Electricity and the Wealth of Nations. This is book number 6. I have a podcast, the Power Hungry Podcast, which, it's over there. There it is, the Power Hungry Podcast. I've done 210 episodes or so. This week, we released one with Grace Stanky, Miss America 2023. She's very impressive.
Very brilliant young lady. Yes.
I'm going to do a lot of public speaking. That's how I make my living. I've done 37 speaking engagements this year. I was in Des Moines yesterday talking to the Iowa Association of Electric Cooperatives. And I'm also a film producer, so I'm fully employed. There's plenty to talk about when it comes to energy and power these days.
It must have been kind of refreshing to be out in Iowa talking to real people instead of focusing on all this nonsense at COP28, huh?
Well, you know, I'm incredibly fortunate in my career, and I'm just so happy with my ability to do what I do. And what my job is my purpose and my passion, and, you know, energy and power and understanding them and helping other people understand them. But yes, absolutely. Talking to people who, those are my people. I'm from Tulsa. I love the people who build things, grow things, and make things. Those are the people that I hope to represent and I want to represent their view because they are underrepresented in all of these discussions, and they are representative. And I've written about this many times, the urban rural divide. And so, you know, people, I was talking to a guy yesterday, he's a cattle farmer in Iowa, and we talked about what beef prices are. Beef prices are strong and, you know, business is good. And, you know, but that matters to me because talking to people who are actually involved in the real economy of making things, and that's part of the divide, the producers and the consumers, and they are getting further and further apart.
Yeah, I'm like you. I grew up in a little town called Beeville, Texas, in South Texas. And so that's my orientation to life. And I find myself having, you know, feeling a need to go back every once in a while just to get grounded again in what the real world is really like and get away with
with all this stuff about COP28 and federal energy policy. And as we record this, we're in the midst of COP28 and all of the global elites having flown their private jets into Dubai. What is your take on what's been happening out there so far? Are they, you know, is there really a prospect for them accomplishing anything of real substance this time? I know that's a hard question.
Okay. So let me, I will first say no. If the real substance is making dramatic cuts in CO2 emissions, right? There have been a lot of pledges and there's been a lot of talk, and we've heard about this since Copenhagen, Paris, Kyoto, you know, all of these meetings, what you name whichever one, they end with this flourish of, oh, we've come breakthrough, something, something, something. And what happens? CO2 emissions continue to rise, and they're going to set another new record this year. Global coal demand will set another new record this year, 8.4 billion tons. U.S. oil production and U.S. natural gas production is at record levels. So my short answer to all of this talk about the energy transition is that there is no energy transition. That, in fact, right. This is a lot of marketing and a lot of propaganda. And I use that word very carefully. I don't like that word, but I think we have been inundated. And the numbers show that when you look at press coverage numbers about this idea, the phrase energy transition skyrocketed during the, you know, as soon as Joe Biden came into office. So we are being inundated with these ideas around the energy transition. But in fact, hydrocarbons are here to stay, and the growth of renewables is not even keeping pace with the growth in hydrocarbons. So much less supplanting significant quantities of hydrocarbons. So that's a long answer to your very simple question. But the one thing that is happening in Dubai that I think is heartening and hopeful, and it's something that is the focus of my last document, or partly the focus of my last documentary. It's been something I've been writing about now for 15 years. It's the focus of the new docuseries that we'll be putting out in January. At COP28, this pledge to triple nuclear capacity. This is a very pro-nuclear meeting in Dubai, and I think that is long overdue and very welcome, and is absolutely essential, regardless of what you think about climate change.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, if you really want, you know, low carbon output, nuclear is really the only way to get there. And it has a lot to do with the theme you really emphasize consistently in your writing and your discussions, the iron law of power density.
Yeah.
Right. And solar and wind simply are not viable solutions to replacing fossil fuels in power generation, are they?
Exactly. And so the power density, this is an idea that I've been years studying why it matters. And I'm not going to be humble about this. I have written some of the most cogent analyses or understanding why power density matters. So what is power density? It's a measure of energy flow. It can be harnessed from a given area, volume, or mass. So why do we care about power density? Because if you care about the natural environment, you care about the natural world, you want to understand why power density matters. And so small footprints are the environmental ideal. One of the reasons why I'm an avid opponent and an avid critic of the wind industry is because it requires so much land. You need massive amounts of land because the power density of wind energy, and I don't care where you put it, is 1 watt per square meter. The power density of nuclear, 2,000 watts per square meter. Roughly at Indian Point, the now closed nuclear plant. Some of the plants are even higher than that, depending on where you put the ring, where you ring fence it. So the iron law of power density says the lower the power density, the higher the resource intensity. If you have low power density, you need lots of land, you need lots of copper, steel, neodymium, iron, boron, magnets, you name it, to counteract that low power density. So this is absolutely key. So when I say I'm pro-nuclear, regardless of what anyone thinks about carbon dioxide and global warming, and my view is carbon dioxide it's obviously a greenhouse gas. Climate change is a concern. It is not our only concern. But regardless of what you think about that, if we're serious about expanding the amount of electricity globally and doing it with minimal environmental impact, nuclear is the only way to go in addition to natural gas, end to end, natural gas to nuclear, something I've been promoting now for 15 years.
So, you know, we have this new generation of modular nuclear technology coming online, molten salt and other technologies. Do they actually enhance nuclear's power density with the new generation, or is it essentially the same?
Well, I'll rephrase what you said, David, and I'm happy to talk about this. We could take up the whole 30 minutes talking about small modular reactors and SMR. I would say the promise of SMRs is enormous, right?
Yeah.
But we have not begun to see that yet. Now, with the exception of there is one that is permitted and is underway, and that is the BWRX-300 that's being built at the Darlington Station in Ontario, Canada. So that project is going forward. There are no projects going forward in the U.S. right now. They did have firm contracts. NuScale Power has a light water reactor designed. They are traded publicly under the ticker SMR. There's been a lot of attention to them. I've been following the company for a very long time. I interviewed one of their presidents now, 12, 15 years ago. So I've been following the company a very long time. But they're being hurt by high interest rates, as are the renewables. The nuclear sector is being hurt by high interest rates just in the same way that the renewable sector is. So there's a lot of promise with small modular reactors, but we have to be very sober and very clear-eyed about the prospects for the future, because the hurdles, and I've written about this on my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com, that it's the challenges, there are many challenges, but there are three main ones, which is regulation, capital, and fuel. And all of those have to be addressed in the regulatory part of that with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the U.S. I'm not going to say it's insurmountable, but it is incredibly difficult. NuScale, I talked about them before, it took them 6 years and $500 million to get their design approved by the NRC.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, just insane what our government does in this space. Back to COP28 for a second before we get off of that. Is there anyone at COP? There's 70,000 people there, apparently. Is there any one of them that has any real understanding of the energy needs in rural America, in Iowa, Beeville, Texas, Tulsa, Oklahoma? Is there anyone there who is in a position of decision-making position at COP28 who has a real, true understanding of the energy needs of rural America?
Well, I don't know that I can't answer that. I would assume there is one or two, maybe out of 70,000.
Yes.
You get a big enough sample size, you'll find someone, right? And they're going to have common birthdays as well. So, but what have we heard is the oil producing nations and Saudis and the others saying, yeah, we're not going to quit using hydrocarbons. I mean, there's this fundamental tension, I think, in all of these meetings and the fundamental tension in all of this policymaking between the energy realists. And my credo is energy realism is energy humanism. And I'm for energy realism because energy realism is energy humanism. Yes. So there is this very clear divide between the energy realists, and I would include the oil producers among them because they know there is no substitute for oil. So, but this tension at COP28, it's the same that we've seen in other meetings like this between the producers and the consumers. And the consumers want to wag their fingers at the producers and say, oh, you shall not, and we're going to switch this and we're going to do that. But I think that, yes, there are energy realists there, but they're not the ones that get the bulk of the media attention. It's the energy scolds, it's the climate catastrophists who get the bulk of the attention, and they then make a lot of pronouncements and say, we're going to do X, Y, and Z and cut emissions and cut his energy use. And, you know, they keep saying that, but what happens, energy consumption continues to rise.
So, speaking of the catastrophists, obviously Al Gore is there. I'm not sure anyone listens to Al Gore anymore outside of these conferences. And John Kerry, whose big announcement the first week was I'm not sure how he has the authority to do this, but he committed the United States to participating in a multinational coalition that is pledging to do away with what do they call it? Unabated coal energy plants, coal power plants. Does the United States have any unabated coal power plants currently in existence? Well, I mean, have we built one in the last 70 years?
The last plant that was built, now this is to my knowledge, it was the ultra supercritical coal plant called Prairie State in Southern Illinois, which is owned by several public power districts. And I think there's some co-ops. Peabody Coal was one of the original partners in getting the project built. I don't think they have any equity interest in it, but that was one of the last coal plants built in the United States. But I think that the whole issue of coal is one that I've written about repeatedly. And, you know, for Kerry to make this pronouncement, I need to write something on my Substack. I've been, you know, busy traveling and doing other things, you know, like you, I'm sure I have more ideas. I mean, you publish more than I do, and I'm a prolific output, but a lot more ideas than I can actually get published. But this idea that we're just going to suddenly, this global we are suddenly going to quit using coal is just flat wrong. And what had happened, I thought there's this, again, this divide between the realists and what is actually happening in the world and the policymakers and the, you know, the catastrophists. And Gary, I would put in that catastrophist camp. Oh, well, we'll just quit using coal. Okay, fine. So the day before, the Wednesday before, the Thursday that the meeting at COP started, Reuters reported that India recently announced they're going to build 17 gigawatts of new coal-fired capacity in the next 16 months.
Yeah.
This is India. Everyone points at China. Okay, yes, China. I'm with you right there. Got it. China permitted 2 new coal-fired power plants per week last year.
Yeah.
So this idea that we're suddenly going to quit coal, it just is, there's no basis in reality for it. So while the U.S. has dramatically cut its use of coal, and in doing so, slashed its CO2 emissions, we've done that at a cost. And I think, and I'm pro natural gas, but I think what has clearly happened is we've made our grid too dependent on natural gas. We need that coal-fired capacity. I'm opposed to closing any of the existing coal plants that we have in America. We need to keep those plants open.
Yeah, I think we do. I think that's absolutely right. And natural gas is a great answer to a lot of it, but it can't be the answer to everything.
And it can't be replicated, and our use of natural gas cannot be replicated by really any other country in the world. Why not? Because at Henry Hub, I don't know, look today, it's under $3. Natural gas in the U.S. is dirt cheap. I mean, just dirt cheap. And we have this infrastructure, this pipeline network that is unbelievable and has been built over more than a century. There's no other country in the world that can replicate what we did in supplanting the amount of coal that we did in the power sector that happened here. That just can't be done. So I'm very pro natural gas, but because it's a just-in-time fuel, that presents problems when we are in emergency situations like Winter Storm Elliott, like Winter Storm Uri. And we've been warned very clearly, and I wrote about this on my Substack, robertrice.substack.com, about the near disaster in New York City where Con Ed almost ran out of gas. I mean, the catastrophe that would occur there is just unbelievable. But I point my fingers at those bastards at the NRDC and the Riverkeeper that forced the closure of the nuclear plant at Indian Point. That is part of the reason why nuclear and natural gas has become so important to New York and why they're close to running short during emergency times. They've become too dependent on gas.
Yeah. And of course, their refusal to allow pipelines to be built in New York, across New York from the Marcellus Shale to supply both New York and New England states with natural gas is a big part of that insanity, right?
Absolutely.
It's not the federal government. People blame the feds for that. But really more to blame is the state government in New York for that.
And who is the one that is guiding that policy? And it was Andrew Cuomo, Governor Andrew Cuomo. Right. See you later, you sorry bastard. He was the one who was taking marching orders from the NRDC and these environmental groups, 350.org, these NGOs, they're not environmental groups, these climate activist groups. He was the one taking his orders from these climate activist groups to use the Clean Water Act as a hammer to block these pipelines from being built. Okay, well, congratulations. You blocked them in the name of climate change. And what have you done? You've made your society so much more vulnerable to extreme weather events that if it occurs, the blame belongs on Cuomo and the NGOs, not on the gas company, not on the utilities. They warned. They tried to build the capacity, and they weren't allowed to do so.
Right. Yeah. I
get worked up on this, Blackman. I don't know if I get worked up as you do, but I just I get to a point where it just makes me spitting mad because it's not the rich and the elites that are going to be hurt by this. It's always the poor and the middle class in the form of higher prices and less reliable energy and power.
Well, that gets to the nub of the whole thing, right? As you just pointed out, it's not really environmentalism here. And this whole energy transition, when you analyze it down to its base, is really little more than the most massive transfer of wealth in human history from the poor classes and the middle class to the elite class and to the companies that provide energy. Is it anything more than that? Because we're not really reducing carbon at the end of the day.
Well, I thought a lot about this. And in fact, when I was in Des Moines yesterday, I got a question from the floor. What is motivating these NGOs? And again, I don't call them green groups. I don't call them environmental groups. They are neither. They are pressure groups. They are NGOs. They are an industry of them on their own. And yeah. I call them the anti-industry. It's a $4.5 billion per year business. So let's follow the money. Why is this happening? Because it's a business. These NGOs, Sierra Club, my least favorite organization on the planet, followed closely by Rocky Mountain Institute, NRDC, these other groups that are pushing these policies to ban natural gas, Beyond Carbon, which recently got a $500 million pledge from Michael Bloomberg. His stated aim, close every coal plant, every remaining coal plant in the United States and half of the existing gas plants. That is a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
But what's the motivation? I'm going off on you here. What is the motivation here? Well, it's perpetuation of their own bureaucracy. What a bureaucracy is about. Well, you keep the bureaucracy going. That's the first rule. Make sure you don't run yourself out of a job. So what is the benefit to these pressure groups, these NGOs? Well, they get to go to their donors and say, look, I got the Berkeley City Council to approve a ban on natural gas. Write me another check. And they get another check. But that's all they have to do is push policy. They don't have to deliver electrons or molecules. And therefore, that is part of this battle that is asymmetric, right? It's asymmetric warfare between the policy pushers and the people who actually make things, build things, grow things.
One of the great things you've done, and I think it's a tremendous public service in recent years, is you have chronicled, I think it's up over 600 or 700 instances now of local communities pushing back against proposed wind and solar farms across America. What was the purpose for starting that in the first place?
Just being freaking pissed off. I mean, I'm just hard-headed enough.
It's a great motivator, isn't it?
It is a great motivator. Anger is a tremendous motivator and one that frankly drives a lot of my work. And I say that without any, it's just true that In 2010, I was about to publish my fourth book, Power Hungry, and I got contacted by a guy named Charlie Porter from King City, Missouri, who I looked him up. I did all my due diligence. I tracked the guy's property records down. He talked about the fact that his home had been surrounded by wind turbines and that it had ruined his life and his family couldn't live in their home anymore. He eventually settled and got a settlement from Ameren, which was the company that owned the wind turbines, and then it got a gag order so he wouldn't talk about it. But led me to understand how rural landowners like him were being screwed by big wind and then later big solar. And so I started cataloging these local communities that were issuing bans or rejections or restrictions on wind and solar. And in 2015, I began very systematically chronicling them, at first in an Excel document and now on my website, robertbryce.com. And I finally upgraded, and then in 2021 started publishing it regularly, and I upgraded the interface so it's searchable by state, by year, by wind and solar, by keyword. And so it's the only database of its kind. Since 2015, there have been 603 rejections or restrictions of wind or solar in the United States, and they have happened from Maine to Hawaii. This is the reality, and the New York Times will not report on it. They will not report
of
on
course.
It. And they will not even report on the rejections in New York State. So, this I view as something that is my job as a reporter to chronicle this. And I don't get paid for it. I don't, it's all on my own time, all on my own dime, because, I know these people. I've interviewed them. I have compassion for these people who, many of whom their lives have been ruined. I was in Christiana, Wisconsin. I wrote about it on my Substack in April. And I met with three local people, including one of the town supervisors and a guy who lives in Christiana. It's a little township in rural Wisconsin, southeast of Madison. There was Invenergy, this Chicago-based company controlled by the billionaire Michael Polsky. They were pushing a plan that would cover 8 square miles of the township with solar panels. Some of the best farmland in the world in rural Wisconsin, in Christiana, Wisconsin, growing corn, soybeans, beautiful rolling hills, picturesque farms, and they want to pave 8 square miles of this township with solar panels. And these people are saying, we don't want this. This is going to ruin our township here. And they were facing just getting bulldozed politically and in reality, bulldozed in this headlong pursuit of so-called clean energy, when it's just about the tax credits. And it's not about climate change. It has nothing to do with climate change. It's about the money.
Yeah. And so many of these projects are getting built strictly for the tax credits, right?
Of course.
The other subsidies the federal government offers. But it's taking them years to get interconnected into the power grid because the grid managers can't manage it all. And is that sustainable? I mean, is this model that we're using right now, with all this debt-funded money going to these non-viable projects in many instances, is that sustainable over any long period of time?
Well, yeah, again, how long do we have?
Right, exactly.
We could go on all day. Yeah, but the Inflation Reduction Act, you know, is the latest example of what is in fact a run on the Treasury in the name of climate change. And the run on the Treasury is being led by big business, big banks, big law firms, and big NGOs. And, you know, and big academia, Princeton, Stanford, you know, other outfits that are claiming, oh, we can do all this if we just build enough wind and solar. And the amounts of solar and wind they're talking about are just staggering. You know, the amount of land area that would be covered. Jesse Jenkins from Princeton in May in Mother Jones magazine with a straight face said, oh, yeah, we'd have to cover effectively five states with wind turbines in order to make his cockamamie plan work. Oh, only five states. Oh, okay. Well, gee, that's just not.
And not states the size of Rhode Island.
And you're from Princeton, you have a PhD. So gosh, gee, that must be okay. Right.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah. so the physical cost is staggeringly large, right? We're talking trillions of dollars if we tried to pursue this idea. But the cost in terms of landscape, the blighting of landscapes, the destruction of fertile farmland, the destruction of rural America, rural American communities, that's one cost. But the thing that may, in fact, be, you mentioned transmission, and this may be the issue that puts a brake on this silliness, is the inability to interconnect so many of these projects. Yeah. We'll just double or triple the size of the high voltage transmission grid in the United States. The hell you will. The hell you will. This idea that, oh, we're just going to double or triple, we're going to build hundreds of thousands of miles of new line. No, you're not. You can't get the rights of way. Even if you could get the rights of way, we don't have the transformers. Even if you get the rights of way and the transformers, we don't have the linemen. The saving grace here may be just that, in fact, these spreadsheet jockeys who are keep putting these models together are going, the spreadsheet jockeys models are going to run into the hard reality, or they already are, of the physical world and the financial world. I think there is a reckoning that's going to come due, but it's going to unwind slowly.
Do you think, and I know you get the same question every time you speak, probably every time I speak, someone asks, well, how are we ever going to recover from this? How do we ever start rolling this back? And I'm always kind of at a loss for an answer, but because I can't really foresee any way that happens with our public policy in the United States until we suffer a major energy crisis.
Yeah.
That's always in the past been the only motivator for Congress to begin to reverse course. I mean, how do you answer that question when you get it?
Well, that may well be the case. I hope it isn't. I wrote a piece on my Substack called Bone Chilling, in which I just explained the scenario, how New York City came perilously close to a loss of gas pressure, which during the depth of winter was last Christmas, and how what a catastrophe it would have been. The calamity was beyond anything that we could imagine. I hope we can avert that kind of catastrophe, because that kind of catastrophe would cost untold billions and cost tens of thousands of lives.
Right?
No doubt about it. But I guess I'd answer it this way, David, is that because we are so energy rich in the U.S., we can afford a lot of foolishness. You know, and I natural gas at under $3. Well, at Henry Hub or at TTF in Holland, it's five times that much. The Europeans can't afford this kind of foolishness that we're engaging in. Right. They have to be more sober. And so now we see a much more focused effort in Europe, across Europe, for nuclear energy, which we don't see here in the U.S.
Right.
So I'm optimistic for the U.S. I'm all day optimistic. I'm Homer all the way in terms of the United States. We have incredible advantages over the rest of the world in demography, geography, education, capital markets, all of these things but also just incredible energy resources and a diffused energy system, right? Which isn't under the control of just too few elites. It's very dispersed. So
yeah.
I'm hopeful for the future, but I hope it doesn't take that a major breakdown for sobriety to win out.
Last question.
Sure.
I'm at Substack like you are. Talk about, your focus on writing at Substack, and I think you've talked about it in the past. You write mainly at Substack now, right?
Yeah.
And talk about the reasons why.
Sure. Well, thank you. I've been on Substack now for just about a year, and yeah. I've only written one in that year. Only written one piece that wasn't published first in Substack, and. I've written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. I've published six books. I've written the Christian Science Monitor. I've written for a whole bunch of outlets, but I'm 63. I'm an old guy now, so I am to the point in my career where I remember it vividly. It was last year. I published a piece, and I won't mention the periodical, and then they put a headline on the piece that I didn't like. And they did these edits to it that I thought, okay, well, this is kind of a pain in the butt. And I had to go back and forth and back and forth. And then they published it and whatever. And then I told the editor, I said, I really didn't like that headline, that you put on it. I said, can I get approval on the headline? And the answer was, no, that's our job. We'll do what we know our readers. And I just thought, okay, well, that's the last time I ever wrote for them. And then I was using MailChimp for a newsletter that I was putting out every Friday. And then MailChimp, they got flagged. They withheld one of my newsletters for some reason they wouldn't explain, because their algorithm said something was blah, 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 blah. And I thought, okay, I'm out. I was paying MailChimp to do this. And anyway, when I left MailChimp, I had about 2,000 subscribers, 2,500. On Substack today, I have 12,500.
Yeah.
And so the great thing about Substack, which I think is that it is gaining momentum, because individual readers can see individual writers and say, I trust them, instead of saying, I trust this institution, the New York Times. I don't trust the institution, the New York Times, or the institution of the Washington, that brand. So and I haven't thought about it in this way, but where Substack is so attractive to me is that I can promote me, my brand, and just my brand, and it's just me, and I can write what I want, when I want, how I want, and I can publish my own slides, because I do a lot of public speaking, and I realize people, especially talking about energy and power, you need to show them numbers. You need to be able to show them comparisons that make the story relevant or more impactful to them. So I've been very happy with Substack. I'm not charging. I'm distributing it for free, because I like the power of free, right? But I may go paid. But for now, I'm very happy on Substack. And what I found there, Rick Rubin, the new music producer, said something recently. He said about who he's trying to please. And he said the audience comes last. And I think that there's some relevance that rhymes kind of with what I think, that a lot of what I do on Substack, I'm writing to please myself, right? I'm writing because I want to, this is how I view things. If you all like it, that's great, but this is how I see things. And so it allows me to scratch an itch that no other outlet does. And so I'm very, very happy with it, and just find it to be really a pivotal point in my writing career, in that it allows me to use my own voice in a way that I haven't before.
Yeah, I won't mention the publication either, but my favorite thing is to get a note like you talked about from an editor saying, we know our audience, who's an editor at a publication that's on the verge of bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And obviously you don't, but anyway.
But I think it's also the rise of Substack is part of this reason. It is a reflection of the lack of trust that has grown over time with legacy media outlets, that they've especially the ones that will remain unnamed here, but they've just sullied their own reputations. And so to be able to have my own brand on my own time, on my own dime, I just can't tell you how much I enjoy it.
It's amazingly liberating, and I share your views as well. I still write for several different outlets, and I love them all. But Substack is just it's a unique product that I think is just going to continue to grow, frankly.
Yeah, I do too.
Well, listen, man, we have gone over time here, and I'm thrilled to death we have. And before we go, though, remind everyone about your video series that's coming out at the end of January.
Sure. Well, first, my Substack, robertbryce.substack.com. Subscribe there. I'm also on TikTok. I'm on Instagram. I'm on YouTube, LinkedIn. I'm on every social media platform.
He's easy to find, folks.
I'm easy to find on the Google. robertbryce.com is my website, which is where you can find the Renewable Rejection Database. My film, the first film is called Juice, How Electricity Explains the World. You can find that on YouTube. Our new docuseries, and maybe when it comes out next month, David, you can come back on and talk about it, but it's called Juice, Power, Politics, and the Grid. It's a 5-part docuseries that'll be out on YouTube beginning January 31st.
Well, why don't we just plan to regroup in mid-January and do that?
That'd be
right
awesome.
Before you're coming out with it. That'll be great.
Yeah, thanks.
Robert Bryce, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, David.
And thank you to our extraordinary producer, Eric Perel, our host, the Sandstone Group, and our sponsors at the U.S. Oil and Gas Association. That's all for today.